reporting on the CRA modeling for the analog-ANRO effect.
Thank you. And thank you again to the organizers for arranging and sorting out this conference. It's been a really interesting array of talks. So as Silke said, I'm Cameron. I'm a PhD student at Nottingham under the supervision of Yorma Loco and Silke Weinfurtner. And today I'm going to talk about work we've been doing on some of the experimental considerations for modeling analog-ANRO effect. So it's based on these two papers. The first is mostly theory work, so quantum field theoretic work with Yorma, and then this second work is with our collaborators at Royal Holloway. And one of the benefits of having the talk later in the week is sometimes you get surprises and your talk gets your paper gets approved during the week, so I can share good news. So. So in order to talk about the ANRO effect, we should know what that is. So we're going to have a small primer on the ANRO effect, and I feel like I shouldn't be the person in the room giving this, but here I am. And so here is quite a popular image. It's Feynman's blackboard, and as we can see here, it mentions acceleration temperature, but Bill will tell you that Feynman was in several seminars that Bill gave on the ANRO effect, so perhaps it's no surprise that he was thinking about it at the time. So what do we need to consider when we're modeling or trying to derive the ANRO effect? Well, as far as we need to know, we have a quantum scalar field. And we're considering this in Minkowski spacetime. And if we want to probe this field, we can use a model called the ANRO-DeWitt detector. So there are three components I've introduced here. So we have a coupling constant, that we want to be small. We want to be small so that later we can use perturbation theory. Then we need to talk about how we're going to interact with this field, how we're going to turn on the interaction, how we're going to turn it off, or maybe we'll set it to on and interact forever. And then finally, we have the details that describe the detector itself. So the detector is described as a two-level system, and it has a ground state and an excited state, and the difference between these in terms of energies is what we call the energy gap, which I will label E. So with that in mind, we can calculate to first order in perturbation theory what the probability would be for an excitation of this detector. What's going to make it click? And if you work through it, we find that it's equal to this Fourier transform of a two-point function, which I'll later just refer to as the Wightman function. So maybe we want to consider this on an accelerated trajectory. And if we would do that, we find that these probabilities obey what's known as Einstein's detailed balance condition, which is a balancing of the excitation and de-excitation probabilities, and they get fitted to this exponential curve. And if we see what temperature is associated with this curve, we find that it's proportional to the proper acceleration A, and we have the well-known ANRO effect. But for experiments, we want to consider this in circular motion. So this is a plot taken from Bill's paper from 1998. It's actually published a month after I was born. But so this considers orbiting electrons that are accelerated. So if we take a little look at this, and what is plotted is an effective temperature. So this is what would happen if we rearranged Einstein's detailed balance condition and dictated that this is the temperature that each frequency or each energy gap would have. So we can zoom in on different parts, and we find that we can analytically describe what this temperature is. So some nice easy parts are we like when things are either very small or very large, and so we find that in both cases, if we look in these limits, we find that we achieve thermality again. Although in this mesoscopic region, it's a bit unclear. But if we think about thermality, if we think about how we're going to use a thermometer, does it measure every energy? Perhaps not. So if we were to maybe zoom in on a single part and check, okay, what can our thermometer resolve? Perhaps it looks approximately thermal when we're probing it with our detector. So just a brief comment on using effective temperatures our thermometers perhaps can't probe every energy possible. So that was looking at the circular motion effect, and then this was extended in 2020 to look at a larger parameter space. So if we consider in both 3 plus 1 and 2 plus 1 dimensions, and what are plotted here are the ratio of temperatures. So you have the circular motion divided by the linear motion temperatures. So one's an effective temperature, and one is really the unruh temperature. And then what is plotted on the other axis is the rotational speed v, and also this reduced energy. So we're just dividing out by the acceleration a. Now, if we... Does this work? Okay, so if we look here, we can see that it really does start to plateau. And so the dependence on the energy here is perhaps not that great, and it is approximately thermal. So again, looking at what we've plotted here, we can, just as a reminder, we have an effective temperature and this real linear Umbra effect temperature. So with all this in mind, I want to, as Patrick said, build an experiment, but I must caveat that my experiments are solely on paper. So how can we define the theory on paper? How can we bring this closer together? Sometimes I get told that the things I consider important are vastly different from what an experimentalist considers important, but let's go. So we need to start by defining our equations of motion, and that's equivalent to what we consider our dispersion relation to be. So popular examples of which we've seen today are the surface waves or gravity wave dispersion relation, and we've seen this twice already. And similarly, we have the Bogoliubov dispersion relation for BECs. Now, these are particularly relevant for analog gravity, and they have the feature that if we look at either in the long wavelength limit, or equally the shallow water limit, or if we look at the low wave number limit, we find that both of these are approximately linear. So we have that these mimic our dispersion relation for a quantum field theory, and so perhaps we can forget everything in higher energies and just work in this linear regime and hope that everything is closely related to what we expect. So now come the sort of more non-negotiable points. So perhaps we should consider the initial state of our system. So recalling this excitation probability, all of the information about this initial state is found in this Whiteman function. And often it is considered to be vacuum, but maybe we might consider it to be thermal. And if we were to consider it thermal, how would that change? How would this affect our considerations and calculations? Well, if we play a quick game of spot the difference, we find that we just introduce this beta here, which is our inverse temperature. And I hope it's not too controversial to suggest that labs have a non-zero temperature. So maybe we should, before we say we must consider, before we can say it doesn't matter what the thermal effects are, we should know what the thermal effects are so that we can know we can throw them away, if that is indeed true. And just a small detail, that once we introduce, well, the way we introduce this temperature is via these thermal expectation values. You'll notice that this introduces a Hamiltonian. Now, both in classical and quantum dynamics, if we think of the Liouville equation or the von Neumann equation, we know that the Hamiltonian generates the dynamics and, in fact, gives us a preferred time frame. So given this preferred time, this breaks Lorentz invariance. So for people who do QFT in curved spacetime, that's often not a problem. But since we're in Minkowski spacetime, we often want to utilize all of the symmetries we have. So this is more general in a sense, but we have to be a bit careful with what we're doing. So a third point we might consider are boundary conditions. So up until yesterday, I thought the statement no lab is infinite was completely fine, but now I should caveat that so long as after Marcus's talk, that if your lab or your experiment is not mapped to a Poincaré disk, it is not infinite. So perhaps then we should, when we're considering on paper constraining the field to a finite size, we need to consider a range of boundary conditions. And as in Xavier's talk, Silke mentioned that we don't fully know in the experiments what the boundary conditions are going to be, so we just have to wait and make an informed choice based on the experiments later on. The fourth point is that the experiment will be turned on at some point. Someone has to build it, so it has a finite, well, it began at some point, and then if you want to read off your experiment, you're going to have to turn it off again. So on the flip side, it's easier on paper to consider an infinite interaction time. But can we somehow salvage something from that, from this easier tractable calculation? Well, if our situation or our system is stationary, we can use this infinite time calculation to give us finite time. And by stationary, I mean that our Whiteman function, which I'm just going to call W, is only a function of the difference in time. So this simplifies our calculations much more. And if we do that, we can define what we call a probability rate, which we give the symbol F, and I'll refer to it now as the response function. So this is sort of response rate, but by abusive name, I'll call it a response function. So the way we derive this is if you're careful with limits, you can window the integrals that we had before in the probability and divide out by the total interaction time, and we end up with something looking a bit like this, a derivative. So if we have that, it was shown in 2016 by Christopher Euster, Aubrey Juarez, and Yorma, that we can, in fact, just sort of crowbar in this interaction time, again, using the Fourier transform of our switching function, chi. So this is how we would introduce many of these sort of experimentally relevant concepts on paper. Now, I briefly want to mention that moving from a quantum field theoretic view, how we think about sort of the experimental frame. So we do this by considering, instead of the prop time tau and the energy gap E, we just think about all of this in the lab frame. So I use lab frame time T and energy gap E bar. So our spacetimes are condensed matter spacetimes, such as BEC or superfluid helium. And if we're looking either, as Cisco mentioned, we use the two-dimensional trapping potential, or we look at surface waves, as Xavier mentioned, when consider, for example, third sound, this reduces the effective space-time dimension. And the scalar fields that we consider here are then the perturbations in the system, either density perturbations in a BEC or surface wave perturbations. And there are two proposals here, color-coded per proposal, for potential methods of doing this. And again, to remind that we're going to consider this on a circular motion trajectory, this is a not exactly thermal spectrum, but we can still look at the acceleration dependence that we have here. And in particular, I'll only consider stationary situations, which means that we can deal with only the response function, which is just the Fourier transform of the Whiteman function. So what would happen if we put all of this together? How do we, if we were to consider all of these points, let's say we wanted to consider, it's a bit lengthy, but an unruly Dirac detector in circular motion in a 2 plus 1 analogous spacetime of finite size with Dirichlet boundary conditions at R equals A interacting with the scalar field with modified. Modified is, we mentioned what we exactly mean by here, it just has some mostly arbitrary but mild monotonicity conditions, and we add in a thermal state for a finite time. That is, you write it down, you deal with this. Now, you might consider, okay, what are the exact steps that go into this? How many complications have we added in? Now, if we go back to the calculation, we can, in fact, match this color coding, and we find that it is terribly messy. So, for now, I'm going to only focus on an initial thermal state, because that was quite a mess to write down. So this is now talking about the work, the two papers that I mentioned at the beginning. And this diagram is taken from the collaboration with Royal Holloway and the images produced by Rade, who spoke earlier in the week. So how can we think, how can we guarantee that we have an acceleration-dependent signal? Now, the quantifier of the detector response is this effective temperature. And since we're dealing with thermality, we can wonderfully plot this effective temperature. So we can see that we get a response. This response increases with temperature. Anyone will tell you that it's no you expect that if you increase temperature, you'll increase your response. That's to be expected. But what can we say about acceleration dependence in this signal? Once we broke Lorentz invariance, we then introduced the Doppler effect to our system. And since we have a non-zero velocity, how can we guarantee that anything we see is even due to acceleration dependence? So how much of this is acceleration? So if we subtract away the initial temperature thermal state from the previous diagram, we find that we have this shape. And we can introduce this line. This blue line here shows the equality between the initial thermal state and the detailed balance effect of temperature. So if your detector were looking at sort of an air energy here, and it probed at this temperature, it would see perhaps nothing. You'd think it were a room thermometer. Now, if we did the same, but in linear motion, we'd also see that we have this changing of our temperatures. We have times when we measure above, times when we measure below this sort of ambient temperature of our system. So how do we know that any of this shape is caused by acceleration? We should, again, introduce some sort of quantifier. So let's look at velocity versus acceleration. So circular motion, we just have two free parameters, and we're entirely free to choose the acceleration and the velocity. Now, if we want to compare the presence of acceleration in our signal or not, we should consider a special case of zero acceleration. Now, if we think for a moment what a constant velocity zero acceleration is, we realize that this is just a straight line motion. So if we looked at the response function at for something in linear motion in a thermal bath at the same speed and subtracted this away from our circular motion response, we should hope that this removes the contribution of the velocity. After all, a straight line is nothing more than a circle with its radius with an infinite radius. So this is just a special case of circular motion. And maybe we want to normalize this by dividing out by the linear. And then we have this quantified, which I'll call the normalized difference. So if we plot this, we'll take a more detailed look at in a moment. But the interesting part is all of this is scaled with respect to the initial temperature, the temperature of the prepared initial state. In fact, this means that this entire structure is independent of the temperature. So even when your temperature is so high that everything will be completely dominated by thermal fluctuations, there are still regions in your parameter space that you can find a non-negligible acceleration signal. How do you know that? Well, this is a subtraction of the linear from the circular. So when this is approximately zero, as it is mostly here, then they're indistinguishable. We are just seeing the Doppler effect. But when they do differ, as hopefully everyone will agree, this is, five is probably not zero, then we can see something dependent on the acceleration. So looking closer at these, we'll notice that there is sort of a white line boundary that causes a characteristic change in the detector response. So this is the case when the detector is rotating at the same frequency at which it probes. So this is the resonant case of our system. So it seems to be that if you probe below this resonance, you can get a non-negligible acceleration contribution. But as soon as you go above it, then it all becomes the Doppler effect. So this shows the regions that we should consider if we perform such an experiment. So moving now to the helium setup. So I'm going to focus on initial thermal state. And as Xavier mentioned yesterday, we're going to consider thin film superfluid helium 4. And by thin, I mean that the equilibrium height will be approximately 100 nanometers. So if you decrease the height, this increases the effective gravity through the van der Waals interaction. However, if you make it so thin that you start have to consider the atomic structure, you lose this hydrodynamic analog that Patrick was discussing earlier. So the scalar field in this case are the long wavelength surface perturbations found in the superfluid component, and these as Xavier said yesterday, are the third sound. They're completely decoupled from the normal component, so we can truly deal with a quantum system. So we want to probe this with a continuous laser, when we do this, this change in height induces a fluctuation in the phase of the laser, and this is really what we'd like to read our signal from. Cisco mentioned on Wednesday that this is ongoing, so I'm literally going to call this a black box. We are going to pretend that we have extracted this signal and work from there. So if we want to talk about the power spectral density of our readout, we can relate this to our response function by arguments of dimensionality. So we've introduced four new components here. We have the index of refraction of our superfluid, van der Waals dominated effective gravity, and the mass density of the helium, and then also the wave number of the laser. But for all intents and purposes, we can just call this kappa. So of interest, kappa is, I believe, around 10 to the minus 63 or something like that. It's a very, very small number. So given this, we want to, again, isolate this dependence on acceleration in our signal. So what would the laser read off? It would read a mixture of shot noise and hopefully this signal. And then we estimate the shot noise in terms of the laser frequency, the power, which we consider to be around 0.5 milliwatts. So given this, we want to try and extract only the acceleration dependence in this signal. So as per the normalized difference that I introduced earlier, this should try and isolate the acceleration dependence. The issue is that I have simply introduced a new term that I'll circle now. So we need to measure everything. We can't just input more numbers. We need to measure this directly from the experiment in order to do a signal-to-noise ratio analysis. So it might seem that if we want to measure for an infinite amount of time a straight line in linear motion, this will be incredibly difficult. And it's, in fact, not what we want to do. If we compare what the linear and circular responses would be, we can see that in many cases, they completely agree. So what do we see on this plot? Well, we go only within the linear dispersion regime. And then if we zoom in, we can see that they agree. In fact, this is the small omega regime. So it's dimensionful, but as far as the equations are concerned, this is the small NG regime. And in fact, the linear response is entirely proportional to the energy here. Well, the frequency. And we can see that if we look at the high energy part of our spectrum, then since we know it should be a straight line, if we can approximate the gradient well there, we can interpolate and find that we have this straight line behavior. And then in the lower energy regime, we can see that there is a deviation of around 20% that we should hope to measure our acceleration dependence from. So now comes everyone's favorite type of space exploration. It is parameter space exploration. So we should try and find some regions within our setup that allows us to explore where this signal might be. So here we've plotted this signal-to-noise ratio that I mentioned earlier. And so how do we read this? Well, we have three sets of lines, and they're color-coded such that in the top and bottom panel, they match. So this line corresponds to a circular orbit radius of 80 microns, and similarly for the other three. And there is a second type of line here. We have the dashed line. So this is the resonant frequency that I mentioned before. And in fact, you'll notice that each has this sort of kink at this point. So mathematically, this is just because there is a discontinuity in the first derivative. Physically, I'm unsure why it has this discontinuity there. And in fact, since we're changing the radius on this axis, but fixing the velocity at 95% the speed of the third sound in the system, this is why we get this sort of 1 over r shape here, since your v is r times omega. And again, we have the, with fixed velocity, the acceleration is proportional to 1 over the radius, so we can see acceleration on this axis. Now, looking closer at this graph, we can see that we have, for larger accelerations, we are increasing our signal, except for in this region here. It still occurs, but it's much more subtle. So we want to try and probe underneath this curve to try and extrapolate as much as we can. So let's try instead and fix the radius. We'll fix a radius of 60 microns and exactly the same speed, but maybe we want to vary the temperature. Let's explore more of what our system has to offer. And we can see that we have similar shapes here. And, well, okay, we have the same line structure. They correspond in color. But I'd like to remind that the entire structure we had here was independent of the temperature. So we really should expect that all these curves are identical, except for some sort of scaling that we've introduced. So we plot this at a range of temperatures. And what we find is that this shape is amplified by the background temperature. So this is more the statement of this independence of temperature. It means that, yes, temperature will, it should completely cover everything, but your system still deeply knows about the trajectory it's on. It still knows about the acceleration dependence. And if you did such analysis, you should hope that if you get such a shape, we know it's only contributed by the acceleration. So, and yes, we still have some operational measuring of the linear contribution, so we can still perform this signal-to-noise ratio analysis. So what really is the take-home message of this talk? So the main point I'd like you to remember is that even when temperature is much higher than the energy, even when the temperature is so much higher than the energy, there is still the acceleration dependence in the signal of your laser. You should hopefully feel that this is an effect that sort of wants to be found, this acceleration dependence or trajectory dependence in your signal. And that this gets emphasized by a higher temperature. So rather than thinking that temperatures are always inherently bad and taking this sort of purist point of view, if we allow ourselves a bit more room and some more generosity, we might be able to identify this acceleration dependent structure. So with that, all that's left to say is thank you for listening.
Thank you, Cameron.
Yes, thank you very much, Cameron, for that talk. I was curious, this temperature-independent structure.
Yes.
Here. Does it persist at t equals zero? And if so, why aren't we building our signal based on that structure rather than something that is temperature-dependent?
So, very good question. I feel the issue would be that we have, yes, you could, but you would then need to consider this t to zero limit in, it needs to be balanced with your e to, what do you need to do, e to zero as well. You'd have to, so the shape persists, but the exact energies as this would exist at would change as well. So in fact, this, you would send this line to zero, and what it would correspond to would be your rotational frequency would go to zero as well. So yes, this would affect, you'd try and recover the standard Umbra effect, but the whole point of this is that you'd need to do that in straight line motion here. So you'd have to send your orbital velocity to
zero. It does carry information about the...
Yeah, I mean, that would just recover the straight line motion Umbra effect. If you send t to zero, which, so then yes, it's still, you still get that same structure because the Umbra effect exists.
Okay, just sort of address the second question. Why aren't we building our signal based structure?
Very good question.
Sorry?
Why aren't we building our signal that we're trying to extract based on the temperature independent structure? Is there a reason, or is this just too new and we haven't done it yet?
I don't think there's a reason. We just haven't, and maybe we can now.
Okay. Thank you.
You somewhere said this is kappa was 10 to the minus, I didn't understand, 60 or 16, or what was the value?
Minus 63, I think. Minus 63. Yes.
63.
Okay. Yes.
Or but let's then the other way around. How difficult is it to actually measure this with the, say, interferometer setup?
So the reason it's that small is because once you dimensionalize your response function, you end up dividing by h bar squared. So it's sort of counterbalancing all of that. So it turns out that your response functions, once you dimensionalize them, turn out to be like something like 10 to the 80 or something.
Or the other way, how accurate do you have to measure the phase of the laser beams to actually see this? Or I'm trying to see how difficult it is to measure that.
With that, I think the answer will come when we have our signal extraction sort of protocol fully nailed down. Cisco, you have a...
Thanks. Yeah, the signal-to-noise analysis does actually tell you that it's observable because it takes into account the phase noise at the shot noise level defined by the very accessible laser powers, and it tells you that the phase noise induced by shot noise is not too large to observe it.
I mean, signal to noise is still, I mean, if both signal and noise are 10 to the minus 10 photons, then you cannot measure both. So the signal to noise is not the only thing, it's only the question how big is actually the signal and how long do we have to run the thing to see it. I mean, just signal to noise ratio is not enough to say something. So I just wanted to get a feeling of how difficult it is to measure.
No, so this is still in the infinite interaction time limit for now. So yeah, future.
Just to comment on this, it is the experiment will be run at finite time for a single trajectory. So at the moment, this is how long do you need to measure before your detector makes click? Yama has a paper on this. But you know, the question is also while you're going around with your laser beam, you inject surface or phonon modes, and of course you also have to look at back action effect and how the system changes, so you have to interact for sufficiently long. How long and how the system changes over this time, how exactly this interaction affects the whole setup has to be, you know, partially explored also through experimentation. It's not an easy effect, no? It's not so easy that you just stick a laser in and start steering it and then this wonderful thing is coming out as is. At the moment, doing a signal-to-noise ratio, taking into account how many, you know, that you can have thousands of repetitions or...
So this is with 10 to the... It was either 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5 repetitions.
10 to the... For helium, it's 10 to the 4, no?
I think.
So to get to this noise level... Was it 10 to the 4, Cisco? Or 10 to the... Yeah.
One of them.
In this one. Sure.
Yeah.
So anyway, so of course you can also ask how many, you know, so there's... We're using the statistical power, the fact that you can reproduce this to increase the signal-to-noise ratio, but we also need to understand, you know, what is the ideal way of doing it? How long do we have to do it so that the infinite time calculations are applicable, but then also short enough that, you know, estimates from the back action actually, you know, effect are not changing this significantly. Having said that, these are exactly the kind of things you want to explore. That's why we're doing the experiments, to see how all of the other things affect this measurement. So some of the things will be, you know, very difficult due to the specifics of the system, such as it is in a small box, not even on a plate, as Bill pointed out. These are small devices. But this is also interesting. All of these things we want to learn, they're hard to calculate. If I ask Jorma, can you please... tell me what happens exactly if I have back action, finite size effects, and so on, and how does it finite time and put all of this together and how it withstands the reality. This is what we want to test. It's a hard effect, and it's interesting because it hinges on a lot of assumptions which are testable. Sorry, Kamran, would you agree with me?
Oh, yes.
Oh, taking, okay, good.
Very nice slides, by the way. I'm curious about the boundary conditions, because so in the experiments you talked about, you basically just got a fluid,
yes,
which is in a container. So I would have expected that for the long wavelength excitations, you just have a Neumann boundary condition for the phase, because you can't have fluid leaking out of the box. So why is it that your boundary condition is ambiguous in this case?
So if we're doing it in like thin film helium, as Xavier mentioned yesterday, that you have this sort of ambiguity at the very end, rather than if you put it in a box, you'd just have
right, okay,
the no penetration boundary condition on.
Okay.
Hi. It was a very good talk. I like the slides you made. So you're using like detector in circular motion, mm-hmm, right? Is this an ultra relativistic limit? Because in that limit, you can have exact form for the temperature, right?
So, for example, if you took the relativistic limit, so the V going to 1 in this case, yes, you can write down an exact form. It's completely independent of the temperature of your initial state, and it is, it's quite ugly. Yeah.
Sorry, so, okay.
I mean, the temperature is proportional to, I think, gamma over log gamma, and then it has, an integral plus, I think it's got pi over the square root of 3 Euler-Mascarenhas constants in there. You can write it down, but I didn't for this audience because it was just ugly.
Yeah, but probably now I realize that when you subtract the linear part, right, you said like a velocity independent or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So does it make independent of like actual that velocity, like a velocity of the circular motion? Or is it... like, do you know what I mean? No?
Based on the rationale that a line is nothing more than a circular motion of a circle of infinite radius, so you see it getting stretched out. If we consider the only difference, since you only have two free parameters, if you consider them at the same speed and the same, your definition of velocity, so this is r times omega for your circular motion and just the straight line motion here, this is sort of the rationale behind this subtraction, leaving only information about your other free parameter that the other has been set to zero.
But, come on, could you put back the slide with the with the straight line and the little bump on it?
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps also to... So how... I mean, you know, you don't say we measure one and then we extract the other one. What we want to...
Sorry.
So the straight line mainly is a Doppler shift. What you want to see is in this this scaled up little square, you want to see the hump, this little hump. So whatever your precision is with which you're measuring this line, it needs to be small enough to resolve this extra little hump on top of it, because the straight line is just Doppler. And if you then look at the difference, which is plotted above, but you won't see the difference. What you will see is you get this straight line with a little bit of a bump. And that tells you, you know, the straight line to see is easy, right? As I think what Ralph said, it's easy to see the Doppler effect. But we want to see this tiny difference, which is due to the accelerated observer effect. It's acceleration. I mean, it's acceleration counts, but there is... The radial, you know, it's like the velocity on which you go around and the distance from the center which you build up the acceleration. So acceleration, all of this goes in. How fast you go around, and also what's the distance to the center.
Yeah, if you change the velocity, this would change slightly, but the point is that so the straight line behavior of linear motion is independent of the velocity. If you calculate that limit, the velocity entirely drops out, and then you're just left with trying to calculate this correction to a linear motion.
At the level of accuracy you need to extract these effects, do you need to worry about, so you think of helium, right?
Mm-hmm.
The dispersion of relation of helium is not linear?
No, but if you write down sort of a hard cutoff of, if you show on paper where this limit should be, it will be to the right of this. So this is sort of like a, what we're treating as this dispersive cutoff. And if you made the film thinner, you would send this cutoff further and further to higher energies. So this is how you...
So you've checked the...
Yeah.
The shapes. Parameterization of the... Yeah. And yeah. It's smaller than this effect.
Especially in this region. Yes.
Yeah.
You mean the deviation from the linear curve, how big is the deviation where the bound is from the linear to... Is this what you're asking? The modification...
Where the dispersive effects would hide that, I guess.
Yeah, I'm wondering... Yeah, the dispersion due to the maxon and all this.
So because this is in surface rather than in the bulk, and then these surface excitations in this thin film limit decouple from this sort of bulk behavior is why we can use the gravity wave in the long wavelength limit approximation.
As you make the system hotter, presumably at some point you would start nucleating vortex-antivortex pairs. Has there been any estimate of how?
No.
So, okay.
And then eventually we'd also, yeah, if we continued with our graphs and heated them up, yeah, it would also just destroy everything. So temperature balance.
There's a lot to be learned by doing the experiments and to see, you know, where things hold and where things break down, and then what the implications are thereof. I think, unless there's one more urgent question which we can't shift to the lunchtime, I think it's time to thank Cameron once more.
Thank you.